Welcome to Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I am Justin Landed, and I am your host, and I am joined by two fantastic authors tonight. The first is Rachel Bach, or Rachel Aaron. She's the author of The Legend of Eli Mon Press as Rachel Aaron, and The Paradox Trilogy, starting with Fortune's Pawn, as Rachel Bach, and Nice Dragons Finish Last as Rachel Aaron once again. Thanks for being here, Rachel.
Thank you, and thanks for getting all my names right.
I try. It's the huge amount of research that goes into the show is really staggering. People would just be totally overwhelmed by it. Not really. Sam Sykes is the author of four novels, including the Aeon's Gate trilogy, which began with Tome of the Undergates, and his most recent release, The City Stained Red, which is out now in the UK and out in digital here in the US. He's been called the angriest man on the internet, which is patently false. Welcome, Sam.
Wait, what do you mean patently false?
It's patently false. There are much angrier people.
Like, who took out that patent is what I want to know.
Well, like, it used to be that I was angrier, but then everyone upped their game. And, like, I just can't keep up.
I actually saw Mike Cole type in caps all an entire day.
Really? Was he high or what?
I think it was caps on the internet day.
Okay.
Kind of fake.
Maybe his caps lock was stuck.
Possibly.
And Rachel, you don't seem particularly angry.
No, I'm actually known to be one of the nicest people around. I don't really know how I got this, but I keep seeing people saying, "Oh, Rachel, she's so nice." And like, I don't try to be nice. I just try to be not a dick. And
really?
I guess that's the secret to being nice. You just don't be a jerk.
Wow. Like, I've learned so much already, and we've only just begun.
Yeah, the life lessons.
The bar's pretty low to be nice, I find. Sam, you are actually the first author who has been a repeat guest on Rocket Talk. So
awesome!
Take a bow.
I just did. You can't see it, though.
Well, achievement unlocked.
You would not want anyone else to have this responsibility, this kind of pressure.
It is a responsibility. That's so true.
Like, I have to ensure the continued survival of this podcast by proving we can keep it going.
Well, and now that there's a second Tor.com podcast breaking onto the scene, I have some concern that...
You have some competition.
I do have some competition from Mavesh Murad, who's a former professional radio host in her home country of Pakistan.
Whereas you are recording on two tin cans tied together by string.
Man, I clearly should have jumped ship. I mean, I got the wrong invite here.
Yeah, she hasn't started recording yet. I'm sure you'll get an invite later. But in the interim, I'm still the only show in town. So at least for a couple more months, everybody's
right.
Stuck with me. There's no better option.
So to those of you listening a couple of months in the future, this is why there's no more Justin Landon podcast.
Yeah, there's definitely not a Jason Landon anymore.
Jason Landon is who Justin killed to get this podcast.
You know, my father's name is Jason, so...
Oh, wow. Wow.
That's hilarious.
I just became oddly...
Thank you. Thank you for making it awkward.
That's what I'm here for. All right. Okay. Well, since we've decided to derail the podcast in the first minute here, we can now get back on topic. I invited the two of you here tonight because you actually have something in common, despite being angry and one of you nice, and that is that you both write very... at least your fantasies, and Rachel's science fiction as well, are a lot of fun. They have an energy to them, and they have a sense of, I don't know, whimsy, if you will.
I would say that whimsy is accurate, but perhaps has an inaccurate connotation to it, because whimsy can strike you not about serious topics. And I actually think both my book and Sam's books are about fairly deep issues. We just don't, you know, go rolling in the blood and the dirt and the mud. I've always kind of been like, you know, I'm going to have to hang out with these characters. I want them to be interesting and fun and relatable and people you'd want to hang out with. And that was kind of how I approached all my books, is I wanted to make cool, interesting people. I don't actually enjoy reading, as a reader, I don't enjoy reading dark or sad books, because apparently I live in a land of rainbows, but that's just sort of how I've done it.
That's why you're so nice.
Apparently.
Yeah, I'll agree, whimsy is not quite the right word. I would lean more towards we're not cynical. Like, we still are authors who believe that people try their best, and at some point, good will at least give it a good shot at trying to win out over evil.
And good doesn't have to mean lawful good or any of that
right,
kind of stuff.
It's not, it's not a very rigid definition of good, but, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's sometimes just not giving in to being a dick and living
don't
in
a
crap sack world. Yeah.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah, Rachel, you said something interesting there about we're dealing with a lot of the same issues that maybe some of the darker books are, but we're not sort of reveling in that darkness. And I think that's interesting because it sort of speaks to a motif more than themes or characters, just to sort of wanting to have your reader experience a good time as opposed to a, I don't know, uncontrollable weeping.
A slog.
Right.
It can be a slog. I think...
It can be an emotional roller coaster, and some people really, really like that. Like, I know lots of people who read, like, Joe Abercrombie and other Grim Dark guys, who really, really enjoy the emotional ups and downs of it. But, like, I tried to read The Black Company, and I was just, oh my god, I can't live in this world.
Yeah, I was very confused by The Black Company, but this is neither here nor there. I think that the sort of books we write are with their own emotional roller coasters. They just sort of are in a different sort of tone. Like, I'm very much in love with the idea of a hero up against the ropes, you know, getting the crap kicked out of him, and the reader wondering, how's he going to get out of this one? Whereas I think a lot of the more grim fantasy, when the hero's up against the ropes, they sort of know he's not going to get out of that one. And it's just a matter of how badly he's going to be damaged when he comes out. And it just, each conflict sort of adds to that damage. So I would say it's less of an emotional roller coaster, and it's more that the emotions... It's whether or not you go mainly upwards or go mainly downwards.
Well, it's also like, for example, in my books, I try to always push my characters to kind of the very last inch of themselves.
Right.
Push the characters to the point where they have to make the choice. Are they going to stand on their principles, or are they going to compromise and take an easier way? And I try to always make people who will not compromise, who will keep going and keep pushing for what they believe
right.
in. And so when you get characters like that, they become very strong just through the tempering of the story. And I think one of the main differences in writing a book that, because people call my books light and fun, and I very much appreciate that. They are light and fun, but at the same time, they talk about how they get darker. And I think I don't really think they get darker. I think that the people are still fun. It's just the issues get more serious. Because in the beginning of the books, you know, the first of the series, you're getting used to the world, you're having a fun caper. But there's all these things, especially in the Eli books, that I always intended to be there, that were always there through all the books. It's just now we have to deal with them, and they're not pretty, and there aren't any easy solutions. Everything is very messed up. But the Eli group are still the same people we knew from book one, just growing and maturing as they have to deal with basically bigger and bigger and deeper problems.
Yeah, and the core of those characters does not become compromised. Like,
exactly. Eli doesn't become a grim aggressor man. You know, he's
yeah,
still
like,
a fun thief.
They never go through, like, the 90s comic reboot where suddenly Superman was grim and lobotomized people with heat vision.
Did that happen?
I don't remember that.
I don't believe it happened in the 90s, but you know what I'm talking about. In the early 90s, everything was extreme. You know, these heroes suddenly got very gritty and edgy and started seriously killing or hurting people. But I'm of the opinion that that's a stronger story when there is light to compare to the darkness. Like, I feel when stories are just relentlessly cynical and relentlessly dark, our emotional stakes become lower because we have nothing to weigh it against. And, you know, I've always sort of railed against the idea that Joe Abercrombie is one of those grim writers because he likes setting up heroes who have that light. He just likes seeing them fail more than he likes seeing them succeed.
Oh, see, I can't do it. Jerry Cumby breaks my heart every time I pick up one of his books, and I just,
yeah,
I don't know, I can't keep going on with that.
That's the beauty, because at every time you thought, like, oh no, Shivers, you could have been a good guy. But you're an asshole. Oh dear.
Well, there is a there is a tonal difference between that and sort of the characters who start off dark and just continue to get darker.
Yeah, and you know, it helps that Joe Abercrombie knows how to tell jokes.
Yeah, the comic relief is just so vital. Otherwise,
yeah, like,
just,
which really cannot be overstated. Like, my books have a lot of humor. My characters sometimes don't always take things totally seriously, and, you know, even I get criticized sometimes because I write witty banter in swordplay. And, you know, part of that is just I'm very much in love with the idea of swashbuckling, where, you know, people are, where combat is a chance to develop character. But also because, you know, that does keep people from becoming, like, emotionally constipated, where they are just sitting there clenched and waiting for something to come out.
Which is why you have so many fart jokes in your books.
I think farts are funny. And I have a lot of evidence that suggests they are.
My 5-year-old agrees with you wholeheartedly, Sam.
You know what? Your 5-year-old knows something that you have forgotten. And you know that's her childlike joy. Whereas you are dead on the inside.
All that grim dark I've been reading.
We got grim in a hurry, didn't we? now I'm a huge hypocrite.
Rachel, you said something really interesting a minute ago about how you like characters who don't compromise, who stand on their principles. And it strikes me that there's really an interesting choice to be made there, that if you like those kinds of characters, it seems pretty easily that those characters could turn the other way and be darker and darker and darker because they're unwilling to compromise.
I think it's actually the misunderstanding in the where the compromise is taking place. Because Eli and all of them compromise enormously in situations, and they work with villains to kind of my goal is always a win-win, where everybody's happy. And my characters also try to do, they always try to be clever more than forcing things. And that's true through all my books. Even Devi, who is actually very forceful in my science fiction. But the lack of compromise, and this is going to show what a giant nerd I am. But there's a scene in One Piece, which is an anime, where one of the characters, Zoro, has a knife stuck in his, like, right next to his heart, because he's lost this enormous sword duel. And the other swordsman is like, there's a knife right next to your heart, and if you take one more step forward, you will die. You have no choice, turn back. And Zoro says, I will not turn back, because that is defeat. And if I turn back now, then everything I've ever worked for in my life is meaningless. Because I fought to get to this fight. And so he refuses to step back. And of course it's anime, so he doesn't die. Because
anime.
Because anime. But I love that. And I love the idea of what do you do when the knife is in your heart and the person says if you step forward one more inch, you will die. But if you turn back, all the things you did to get there become meaningless. All the sacrifices you made aren't worth anything anymore. And so it's that choice, that beautiful moment when the character has to decide, I would rather die than give up everything we worked for, that I'm constantly trying to write toward in my characters.
What I really love about what you just said is this idea of meaning. And I think this is where a lot of the strength lies in, you know, for lack of a better term, lighter fantasy, is this idea that things do have meaning because we know we're striving towards a goal and something that isn't like relentlessly cynical, something that's relentlessly self-centered. We're actually trying to improve things. And so we invest a lot in it.
It's a hopefulness. It's eternal. It's in a kind of an eternal belief in the better half of human nature.
Right. And you know, I am very much also in love with that scene, and I write it all the time where one of my characters will just grit their teeth and simply refuse to stay down, and you can break every bone in their body and chew their flesh up, and they will keep going until they are physically incapable of doing so. And I am in absolute love with that idea of something meaning so much that you will give up life and limb for it.
It's a really powerful human moment.
It is because it's almost inhuman, and because a lot of us are driven by fight or flight, and, you know, in such cases, a lot of us will choose, like, oh, well, fuck this, there's a knife in my chest, I'm probably going to turn around and go. Like, this doesn't sound great at all.
Years ago, there was a quote by Teresa Nelson Dean, actually, who works at Quill, said a very lovely thing, which is that fantasy is a genre of significant personal action. Here you have these enormous landscapes, these huge epic storylines, and yet almost every single time it comes down to personal action, a personal choice, the decision to throw the ring into the fire or whatever. And I think that is what all of this ties into, is the kind of the decision to keep going, even if it means your own death, is one of the greatest human choices you can make, the decision to become more than yourself. And I think that's one of the things that makes fantasy so incredibly interesting to me, is that it is such a genre of personal choice and personal striving and effort to become better or to gain this larger good. And I think that's why, at least for me, it's so exciting.
I think you're absolutely right. And that idea of significant personal action, I think that translates very, very clearly into a favored trope, or a formerly favored trope of fantasy, which is the chosen one.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's where things start to go awry, because when it's fated, it's no longer a personal action, is it? Like,
you're not choosing to be the fated.
Yeah, you're not choosing. And thus, it's almost a little meaningless because you were going to do it anyways. And even if you do it, and, you know, even if you fight against it and you resist it and you do it anyways, it's like, well, you know, okay, good for you. You've established and fulfilled the status quo, so it's not that exciting. And I think a lot of blowback to that trope when it was used quite lazily, and, you know, there was a time, I don't want to accuse any author of writing lazily, but there was a time when this trope sort of became standard, and people probably did not put as much thought into it as they used to when it was brand new. And I think a lot of backlash to that trope is what led to, you know, the slow dearth of more exciting fantasies that we're talking about here.
I think also that trope got hideously abused by the video game and cinema and Hollywood industries that kind of jumped into the fantasy boom. When fantasy was really going big, you had this huge slew of just these incredibly schlocky movies and game plots
were
paint by numbers. And
exactly. Well, you know, they in a video game or a movie, you don't have the luxury of spending more pages establishing plot or characters. Like, you need to establish a setting right away. Let's just throw in a prophecy and call it a day.
Well, prophecy is also, I mean, if you're thinking just in the simplest story terms, a prophecy is like one of the easiest ways to begin something. This shall happen, and then it happens, and everyone understands why, and you don't have to explain anything.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a cop-out. Like, if you want to have this deep meaning, you need to spend time investing in those characters.
It sounds to me like Rachel just badmouthed the movie Kroll, which hurts me.
That was the one. Was that the one with the glaive or the one with Kevin Sorbo?
I think the glaive. That's like the little thing that he throws, right?
Oh, yeah. Wow. I didn't see it.
I haven't watched that in so long.
It's really bad. But there's a prophecy in a chosen one, and it's kind of it's like kind of slipstream, like fantasy science fictional kind
of. Sort of like that He-Man aspect where everyone's in loincloths but driving motorcycles.
You know, funny. I won't derail us right there.
No. I desperately want to hear what you were just about to say.
I went home to my parents' house last weekend for a wedding. I went through a bunch of my old toys with my daughter and found the He-Man box. Man, I was really into dudes in loincloth there for a while.
We all were as kids.
It's totally fine.
I was more of a unicorn girl, but I can see the loincloth appeal.
Yeah, you know, that Adam was quite the Adonis before he became He-Man.
Well, now, they had the exact same body type, but no one ever pieced together that once he just took off his shirt, he became He-Man.
Yeah, it's a Clark Kent thing.
Well, like, in the reboot, they at least had him physically transform. It was a good reboot. Anyways.
Did they reboot the cartoon, or are you talking about the live-action movie with Dolph
Lundgren? No, they rebooted. They will never reboot the live-action movie. You can't improve a masterpiece. They rebooted the cartoon, though, and it was pretty good.
Okay.
I have all the She-Ra action figures, but I don't actually ever remember watching the She-Ra cartoon. Like, I have no memories of it, but I had all the action figures. Apparently, I liked it.
She-Ra. She had a really fucked up animal sidekick.
She rode a battle cat or something.
No, that was He-Man that rode a battle cat. She had a horse.
She had a horse, that's right.
I do infinitely regret asking you to pursue this line of thought.
I have a She-Ra story too.
Oh my god. I mean, we might as well.
I had a She-Ra action figure, not a doll, an action
not
figure.
Not a doll.
And we were going through airport security to pick up my mother after a flight, and She-Ra got stuck in the X-ray machine.
Oh no.
And I had a meltdown at the airport that left me crawling beneath the X-ray machine trying to find She-Ra. She never came out.
Jesus.
That's a horrific story.
It was scarring. Anyway, back on track. Rachel, you said something about this notion of being committed to a course and the course that you've committed to having meaning. And Sam, in your new book that's out now, The City Stained Red, there's actually, I think, a fascinating discussion on that subject. And before the book happens, there's this tome, the Tome of the Undergates, that the heroes have been tasked with bringing to somebody, and they're expecting a big reward for bringing this to them. Of course, they don't get their reward, but they spend quite a bit of effort in the book just trying to get that reward, because there's this conversation they're having about if we don't get this reward, nothing else had meaning. The whole adventure didn't have meaning, and all the pain and suffering didn't have meaning. Is that kind of the discussion that you're talking about? Perhaps.
Yeah, sort of. And you know, in The City Stained Red, it's primarily the protagonist, Lank, an adventurer who is very keen to hang up his sword and stop fighting and killing, who's interested in getting the reward, because he figures if he can do that, if he can get the reward, he has enough money to start up a business or, you know, live life doing something other. Yeah, doing something other. But as it goes on, it becomes increasingly clear that he's not going to get his reward, but he keeps clinging to it because, you know, it is a thing. He has killed so many people and fought so hard that he figures if he doesn't do it, then what did he kill all those people for? Does he just live with that? Or does he just say, well, you know, too bad. I mean, he thinks that he'll have to go kill more people to get more money. And it is sort of the other side of that when what happens when you do take that step forward and have the knife in your chest. Like, how badly does that hurt? And that's a question that The City Stained Red definitely asks.
Now, here's a question. So, I was unaware, actually, that City Stained Red was a continuation from your Tome of the Undergates. Do you need to finish the series, or?
No. I'm calling it, like, a Schrodinger's trilogy, in that you can start The City Stained Red and have missed nothing. I wrote it specifically for that. But, you know, if you continue, then, yeah, you'll get more adventure.
What was it like writing about the same people again? I mean, I wrote same people for 5 books, but it was one continuous story that kind of pulled ahead. But
I liked it. It was sort of, we've talked about this idea of a moral core that sort of holds a character together. It was a way to sort of shift that around a little, but still be with characters that I really enjoyed writing about. And that was more or less the logic behind it, is I just really liked these characters and I had more story to tell. But I didn't want to get into that situation where it's like 10 books on and people are really intimidated by starting it. So I wanted to write something that people could just jump into.
And I actually read The City Stained Red before I read The Skybound Sea. So I didn't really feel like I mean, it adds some stuff, but you don't need it. And I felt perfectly fine reading The City Stained Red.
Yeah,
concluding the trilogy.
Yeah, the idea is that if you've finished the Aeon's Gate, then it will add more, but if you start with the City Stained Red, it will not subtract.
That's a nice way to do it.
Yeah. I thought it was cool.
You've intrigued my authorial curiosity enormously, because one of actually the biggest problems I struggle with as an author is that I'll set out to do something and I'll finish it and then I'm like, I'm done. And it doesn't matter if the series is done or not, unfortunately. Like, when I accomplish a thing, I just have nothing more to say about these characters. And people are constantly asking me, for example, am I going to write more in the Eli universe? And I'm always like, well, I don't have any plans. I mean, I never want to say no, but I'm pretty much done there. I've done everything I've set out to do with these people. And so the idea of taking characters that already kind of went through their trials and then putting them in a new series, I just find very fascinating. And now I'm extra excited to read The City Stained Red because, and I haven't gotten a copy and I am very sad.
We will.
But I'll have to go buy one.
Well, I have two.
Oh, wow. So
you're just hogging them.
You have a wealth of options. So he's a true collector. The short answer to that is, like, I'm not done telling their story yet. I do totally get, like, the reluctance to start on something when you've said all you want to say. Because we've all seen that franchise that has the unnecessary sequel. Uncharted is one of my favorite video game series, and it's getting a prequel when it doesn't need it. Like, the whole story has been told. There's absolutely no reason to go on. So if you're done and you're done, I think that's the best way to put it. But at the same time, it's Eli Monpress. There's no end to shenanigans he could get into.
This is true.
But I mean, I am a big believer in the fact that the author's mood will seep into the tone. So if there's a book that has just been written to get a paycheck, it shows. And I try not to do that, which is why I'm desperately poor.
You just need to write tons of books in a billion different genres like I do.
I'm thinking maybe I'll just go dip my toes in erotica, because that seems to be the big one now.
I actually have a funny story about that.
Oh boy. Is this as good as the She-Ra story?
It's better. This is a confession. So right. I wrote an erotica novel about a year ago.
Sure.
And just because, again, I had a lot of friends who were making a lot of money in erotica. Yeah. And I went to this convention and I met a lady who, I bought an island from her Shifter romance story.
What?
She bought an island, like, off the coast of Seattle.
Oh my god.
Or off the coast
god.
Of Washington State. And she's I'm moving next week. And I'm like, okay, I seriously apparently need to try this because I want an island. Who doesn't want an island?
I want an island.
And I always say that, like, making money is not a bad reason to write a book. There's all kinds of reasons, and making money is one of them.
It's certainly not ignoble to want to profit from it, but I do think, like,
the most fulfilling reason.
Well, I mean, I think you don't have to choose if you're interested in a genre, even if the beginning of that interest is fiscal. I think it can certainly blossom into something more. Like, no one who hates a genre goes into it specifically for money. Well, there's probably someone who did, but you know.
There are people who look down on genres like romance, who go into them for the money, and they do not do well.
Yeah, you kind of have to have that infectious enthusiasm. Even if you started, you should definitely like what you write. And if you started for money to buy your own island, and then you happen to write a good erotica, why not?
Well, I wrote erotica.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I'd ever tried to do anything like this. And I actually was pretty proud of it. It came out to be a pretty good little story. It had a really cool world. Like, I was far more interested in the world and the setting than the sex.
Yeah.
So there's this really cool, unique magic system that is fueled by
sex. Oh my god. You started world building in your erotica.
Did you Sanderson your erotica world? Like, this magic system?
It was actually very, very cool. And I'm really sad that I can't use it because it's, you know, it's all sex fueled. So you can't put it in, like, a PG book. But anyway,
now,
so I went through Laura's cave with it. Right. And it came out, I think it sold maybe 100 copies total.
Oh, wow.
In
an
entire lifetime. And it's been out for at least 2 years. It did not do well. And now it's trapped in all this Alora's Cave implosion that's going on. And so I can't ever get it back. It's like lost to the floor.
Dear.
It's sort of like the book that could have been. But the point of all this is that's like it took me freaking forever to write that erotica because I wasn't interested, really. Like,
yeah.
I was interested in the world building and the magic, and the plot was pretty cool. And the characters are also kind of neat, but just as a whole, like all the individual pieces were fun, but as a whole, it just, it didn't. And I was only doing it for money, and I was only doing it for a paycheck, and I'm like, you know, I can't do this. I have to write sort of the books that excite me and the books that I find interesting. And this is not to disparage anyone who really does love erotica. Do what you love.
Throughout that whole story, I have just one question. Like, was the sex involved in the magic system?
Well, so basically, and not to give too much, because I don't want to get outed, but by any of those 100 people who bought it, but those people all loved it, by the way.
Oh, nice.
I had a very good rating. But anyway, so the idea was that there are basically all these different, it was kind of a neo-Roman, like it was this kind of fantasy Roman empire, and there are all these gods who had chosen, who were like avatars.
Yeah.
And the main character happened to be the chosen of basically the goddess of sex.
Okay.
And so all her powers are powers of desire, making people want things and want sex. But it was also like food and like avarice and greed and that kind of thing. So she could do all sorts of stuff with it.
Huh.
And she'd been sent on this mission to go find this new chosen, because the chosen can't actually come into their powers until they're like sexually awakened.
Oh my goodness.
And I'm blushing enormously right now. So, but anyway, so that was the story. And it was actually, I had this whole pantheon, because there are all these other chosen of other gods who also had their own powers that weren't sex-related. She just happened to be the sexy one.
I know you don't want to be outed, but I think we're going to have people actually searching for that now, because it does sound actually kind of cool.
You could probably scavenge all the world building.
Yeah.
and just ignore the sex goddess in your features.
If Alora's Cave will not freaking give me back my rights, I'm just gonna like scavenge the world, just write my own stuff in it, and just say, oh yeah, and there are these sex avatars. Ha ha, we don't talk about them.
Yeah, totally do that. I'm interested in this.
Because it was this really cool, like, fantasy Rome. I'm really into fantasy Rome. Like, I really like Codex Alera.
That's interesting. I just read my first ever romance novel.
How'd you like it?
I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
Who was it?
I read a Courtney Milan, The Duchess War. A bunch of us on Twitter got together and read it. A bunch of bloggers.
So the blogger collusion is real. Like, we always talk about them maybe getting together, and now you're saying, yes, it is.
True. We got together and read it, and there were two men in the group, myself and Neil Harrison from Strange Horizons. And it was very, very interesting.
What's it about?
A timid young woman who is hiding her identity from society because she has a sordid past. And although not sordid as you and I would consider it, but sordid for the era. And she sort of has a chance encounter, not sexual, with the Duke of the region.
Always a freaking Duke. Always.
And they have sort of this sort of like this building love affair. But the interesting part is, like, they're all really good people. I mean, it actually fits within this discussion that we're having about lightness or goodness, because there's not really all the characters, not really a bad guy in the book. I mean, there is one guy who's kind of an asshole, but the two main characters, they treat each other with this high level of respect, and they are very kind to one another, and they have this steamy romance that's building. But somehow Courtney Milan creates this tension around goodness.
I think that's actually kind of easy to do, because I've always said that a good conflict does not just ask what happens if we lose, but what happens if we win. Like, this is the appeal of love triangles, is they might all be nice people, but at the end, someone's going to go home lonely, unless there's a surprise threesome.
Well, I'm a really big Courtney Milan fan, and actually I'm a really big Regency Romance fan. I have, like, I think 290-something on my Kindle. I read a lot of Regency. But I like it for a lot of the same reasons you mentioned, because in romance, a lot more than I think in any other genre, there's this sort of emphasis on being a good person and being a person of good worth. And sometimes that can go really bad. I've read a lot of romances that have very goody-two-shoes, boring main characters. And it's made me, actually, I want to write a series of romances called The Mean Girls of Mayfair, which is, like, all the romance villainesses actually get their own books. Like, the catty socialite gets her own book. Whatever. I really want to do this, but moving on. But I really do like the Regency Rose, and I really do like Courtney Milan, and that she's another good author is actually Tessa Dare. Her books are, one, hilarious, and two, have these really awesome people, and she's a master of tension, and not just romantic tension, but like plot tension. One Dance of the Duke, actually, I think is my favorite romance author, or favorite romance novel of all time. It is fantastic. And it's, again, about kind of a wallflower girl who gets swept off her feet by a duke, but not at all the way you'd expect. And he's actually this kind of very socially awkward man, and it's really funny.
And I love puns, which seem to be kind of embraced within the genre.
Oh, yeah.
Some people are very snooty about puns. I love them. So anything that wants to do some puns, I'm all in.
You like puns, do you? Did you not come to my pun contest?
No.
Yeah, I submitted 10 of my best puns, hoping one would win, but no pun in 10 did.
I'm editing that.
The best part of a pun is that it makes whoever hears it angry.
Or groan. Like most jokes make you want to laugh, puns make you groan. The best puns make you groan.
Puns make you upset that you got that, you find it funny.
Yes. You're like mad at yourself.
It has to circle all the way back around so that it becomes funny again. It's so bad.
So, Rachel, you kind of mentioned that romance does this a lot, this sort of there's value in being a good person. And the whole thing that underpins this whole conversation we've been having is that by writing fantasy that's about making good choices, or if a term that we've kind of agreed we don't like, but a light fantasy or lighthearted fantasy, that all sort of indicates an assumption that we are seeing more and more fantasy or fiction within science fiction and fantasy that isn't that way, that is darker and less fun.
Sounds like you're dancing around a word there.
Like, well, I don't want to use grimdark because I don't
think... Oh, you did!
Buzzword. But I don't think it encompasses the whole picture. But
yeah,
because I think it gets a lot of stereotypes associated with it. But for lack of a better word, we're seeing lots more grim, dark stories. It seems to me. Why do we think that is?
Oh, I'm not really sure why that is. I grew up very much in kind of the 90s fantasy, which is a lot more, I think, like what Sam and I write, where, you know, it's kind of, there's no real question that the hero is going to be good. And he may take a while to get there, but eventually, you know, he'll do the right thing, or she will do the right thing. And I think in a lot of ways, again, for lack of a better term, the grimdark, the anti-hero fantasies and whatnot are a reaction against that. And then people are like, oh, I kind of like this. And they kind of went further and further down. And I think it's also it's a subgenre. I think if people like it for its own benefits, and there are people who just really, really enjoy it, and, you know, more power to them. But I like how wide fantasy is as a genre. I like that one bookshelf can encompass me and, you know, Tracy Hickman and Sam Sykes and Inka Jemisin and Ursula Le Guin. And I like that we're just all in there together and that there's so much choice. Because the definition of what is a fantasy novel is so broad and so huge that there really is something for everyone. If you like grimdark, it's there. And if it has been growing lately, I think it's because it's having a bit of a... It's had a couple of very good authors who've done very well, and that always makes a genre blossom. You know, in the next couple of years, it could swing another way. It could swing back to more fun. But again, there's a difference between, like, my books and Terry Pratchett's books, which are much more comedic than mine, and really awesome. But again, even there, even though we're both technically kind of on the lighter end of fantasy, we're entirely different in the way that we tell stories, because his books are much more about the joke and the inherent humorousness of the setting, whereas mine are funny people doing serious things.
Right.
And so, but again, it's like, even though we're both on the same side of the spectrum, we're entirely different. And that's kind of, I think, one of the real beauties of this genre that we write in, is how big it is and how it, there really is something for everyone to read.
I will totally agree that it began as a reaction against older type of fantasies, because I think the tropes became a little stagnant in these older fantasies, where everything was overly sanitized. There was the good guys and the bad guys would never do anything interesting because you knew they were good and bad. It's not
blame D&D. D&D for that.
It's definitely possible, but you also had a lot of other nasty tropes, like the character who was solely comic relief, like Tasselhoff Burfoot, or that, God, I can't even remember. It was some kind of swine herd.
In what from book?
The Wayfarer Redemption is what I'm thinking of. But, you know, like, these tropes became very easy, and we started seeing a lot of them, and it stopped sort of reflecting a changing world. Like, suddenly people were saying, well, now, why are orcs always evil? Why does no one ever really seem to really lose it? Why does no one stay dead? It sort of grew from there, and you had a lot of authors trying to outgrim each other for a while. But in terms of the tide turning, I think we are actually inching back towards more sort of thrilling fantasy, as it were. I just want to take a moment to speak highly of Brian Staveley, who wrote The Emperor's Blades and The New Providence of Fire, which I've been absolutely enjoying, just for how very exciting and thrilling they are. And They're still very serious, but they're not cynical, and I really appreciate that there's room for that kind of fantasy here.
What about you, Rachel? Is there anything out there kind of fits within this idea of something that's not grim that you would point folks toward?
M.K. Jemisin's Dreamblood series, I've heard people describe it as grimdark. I didn't really think it was. Certainly very bad things do happen. It is a very grim world, but it's not grim for grim's sake. I actually really dislike the grimdark as a genre, because it kind of implies that, like, a grimness competition, who's grimmer than others?
Yeah.
How grim can we be? And yeah. I think that's kind of an unfair thing to do to an author who just wanted to write a dark story.
I mean, that's the hazard of any trend, I think, is like...
Well, readers like what they like up until a point when they don't like it anymore.
Well, yeah, clearly grimdark has resonated with some readers, and that's great. The genre is absolutely stronger for having more people and more voices in it. But yeah, we have sort of been going down this road a while, and I kind of got tired of it pretty early.
Well, one of my big problems that I have with Grimdark, and this is, again, of course, totally not representative of all authors,
right?
But the amount of sexual violence that happens in Grimdark, and characters doing really horrific things seemingly for no reason. Like, just because it was there and they were bad people.
Yeah,
and for me, that's an instant book across the room. I don't do the... Especially not the senseless sexual violence. I just can't read it. I feel that especially a lot of male authors, and again, I'm not calling anyone in particular out, but I feel this is a trope within the genre, give a lot of male authors doing very horrible things to their female characters in the name of character development. And that is one of the reasons I personally have stayed away from the genre, perhaps unfairly, because, you know, I don't want to paint everyone with the same broad brush. But I certainly have not, and a lot of the... I certainly have not gone and sought it out, because there's so much else I can read that doesn't have this stuff in it.
Absolutely.
And I actually talked about this in my blog, that about writing sexual violence and things like that, about how, you know, with the enormous statistics that are going on for women who have been sexually abused, and men, you have to, when you write about that and just use it as a plot trope, I mean, one in four women of your reader, in your audience, have had that personally happen to them. And
yeah.
I feel that's just excessively irresponsible as an author to do that and not treat it with respect, not treat
right.
it as something, as a very serious thing that someone may have experienced personally.
I do totally agree that it is still overused, and it is very present in Grimdark, and especially, you know, what really makes it aggravating is that it's sometimes there almost as an establishing shot. It's like, Well, how am I going to let them know that this is a grim, gritty world? Oh, I know. I'll throw in some sexual violence.
Yeah, I think it's become shorthand. It's almost to the degree that how can I accomplish this in 300 words or less?
Yeah, I do want to make a statement and say that might... I don't think that began with Grimdark, though, and I think that's actually a lazier holdover trope. Because even in the sanitized world of fantasy back in the day, there were, you know, the shorthand for establishing a villain was to have him threaten a woman.
Yeah, they definitely did not invent it, but they certainly have taken it and run with it.
Yeah,
like in Mark Lawrence's Prince of Thorns, like the very first paragraph, the main character condones the raping of village women. It's just sort of like to show how grim the world was, and I just couldn't finish it because of that scene. And that's right. Just me, but I know I'm not alone.
No, you're not alone. I mean, I'm definitely quite weary of it as well. I read a book that just opened with a woman getting abused, and I instantly stopped. Like, it's not that I can't handle it, it's just like, it's given me no reason to think that this is being handled respectfully, and it's, I mean, that's the very, when it's being used as an opening scene, that's almost like the very definition of shorthand, isn't it?
It's like, instead of, it was a dark and stormy night, it's a woman gets abused, and it's,
yeah,
doesn't mean anything, it's just there, window dressing.
You know, it's very lazy, it's not going anywhere, and it's certainly not interesting for the audience. Like, it's not even that it's not fun, it's just becoming not interesting. It's the equivalent of Tolkien describing trees. And yes. It's a serious issue that should not be treated quite so lightly.
Not that you can't write that stuff, you can write anything, but it's all in the execution. Execution is everything.
Right. You know, it's got to be, it's a severe issue. It's got to be treated severely.
Since I've had kids, I've become extremely intolerant of violence against children.
That happened to me too.
And it actually disturbs me that I don't have that same reaction to that degree with violence against women. I think it's interesting that we seem to treat that violence against children differently than we treat violence against other people. Not that it is horrible, of course, but I don't know that violence against children is any worse than violence against women. You know, we're splitting hairs here, and yet we have one visceral reaction to one thing, and then somebody may have less of a visceral reaction to the other, just because it's become so tropey that you just gloss over it, you read over it, you don't have a reaction to it, which I think over time lessens its impact, which is dangerous when we're talking about something that's as pervasive as it is.
Yeah, and I think the real lesson to draw from all this is don't be a lazy writer. And don't tolerate lazy writing if you're a reader. Like, don't tolerate that. That writer does not deserve your money if they're going to be lazy about your story. Kind of my way of thinking.
Right. No, I'm in total agreement with that.
Well, I've got the subject here. I will just give a shout out for The Goblin Emperor by Catherine Addison, which is a fantasy novel out earlier this year.
It is so good.
It really is. It is a novel about goodness. I mean, the main character is really desperately trying to do the right thing throughout the entire novel, and it's incredible how refreshing it was when I read it, because I read it sort of after a few darker books, and it was just like a breath of fresh air. It really was, and I'm hopeful that we're going to see more books like that.
And I specialize because you have to the author who wrote it, who also wrote a series under her, I think her real name, which is Sarah Monet, about Melusine, which is this incredibly dark city. And those books could really actually be called grimdark. Because, I mean, the city is terrible. The main character, Felix, one of the main characters, Felix, is a horrific, horrific individual. Who gets slightly better, but not very much. And Mildmay, my personal favorite character, is a good, his brother is a good man, but constantly, like his leg gets broken constantly. Things are horrible. Things are happening. It's like he's being punished for being the only likable character in the series constantly. And so to go from that to the Goblin Emperor, I very much hesitate to say one set of books is different is better than another. Because Melusine is really freaking good, as is Goblin Emperor. but the difference in just, it lets you see how one writer can handle tones so amazingly differently, just through a very kind of a simple shift of emphasis of the scenes and a shift of character. And I just found that absolutely fascinating. And I'm a giant Sarah Monet fan. It's actually kind of debilitating sometimes.
Wow. I feel like when we started talking about The Goblin Emperor, I felt like, wow, I should read this. But now I feel like my life is just completely incomplete now, having not read it.
Well, her early books, though, are super good. Like, Melusine is probably one of my favorite, like, weird, dark worlds. That city is just the coolest thing that ever was.
It is interesting that you say those books would be called Grimdark, because so rarely do we hear women authors get called Grimdark, which is a whole other can of worms.
Oh, yeah. It's really annoying and obnoxious.
Well, I very much appreciate you both coming on tonight to talk about this. We went rather far afield and did several off-topic sidebars, but it was a lot of fun. So thank you both for being here. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
This has been Rocket Talk.
Bye!